I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports to order for Tuesday, March 14th. So our first item of business is going to be, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2013. Zena, would you summarize for us?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, House Bill 2013 modifies eligibility requirements for lead preschool teachers under the preschool program administered by the Early Learning Division. It permits lead preschool teachers to have at least a bachelor's degree in a field not related to early childhood education under certain circumstances. It directs the Early Learning Division to provide guidelines and technical assistance to programs to address salary disparities among preschool teachers and preschool staff. It authorizes the Early Learning Council to develop strategies to increase the mean salary for preschool staff. It directs the Early Learning Council to conduct an evaluation on financing to ensure access and quality and to determine how compensation and professional development contribute to a high-quality workforce. It requires a progress report. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There is a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no amendment this time.
Thank you. Madam Speaker.
Mr.
Welcome.
Chair. Thank you. It's nice to be here. Members of the committee, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. I can't believe this is my first time in the committee already this session, so it's nice to be here. Before you today is House Bill 2013. It's a pretty straightforward bill, but, you know, I think you've had the opportunity to hear about Preschool Promise. I think last month you had a strong informational, I know, about that. Back in 2015, we passed House Bill 3380, which set up the Oregon Preschool Promise, and you've been hearing about some of the really innovative things that are happening around the state in the pilots to start to create that network of affordable, quality preschool that we want every child in this state to have, and there are a lot of good things happening. But like any new program, there's always opportunity to reflect on, did we get it right, or the things we need to adjust, and what you see in the bill today is an attempt to look at ways to amend the Preschool Promise program around some of the educational and salary requirements that were in the implementing bill in 15 to make sure that we are reducing barriers to participation in a way that promotes quality but also recognizes the diversity and, to some degree, lack of workforce out there in terms of professional development. You know, one tenet of the Preschool Promise legislation was to further a high-quality and effective early learning workforce. Before I even started doing this job, I worked for Children First, and we would have these conversations about how do you get your early childhood educators to pursue professional development, to get a better salary. In fact, when we were successful in 2007 to expand the employment-related daycare program to increase our reimbursement rates, I had a preschool or a child care provider come up to me after that and said, I'm so glad you increased the rates. We were way below where we should have been, because all my folks are now going to go take additional classes. They're getting paid more. They want to stick around. They want to see this as a career. What we pay people in the early childhood workforce and the expectations we place in terms of professional development are really important. They're important for the kids, but they're also important if we're going to have a truly statewide system that can promote quality. In the implementing bill in 2015, there was a strict bachelor's requirement for lead workers in the Preschool Promise program. So what you see in 2013 today is an attempt to correct that to make sure we're not excluding other qualified teachers to be involved in Preschool Promise. So on page 2 of the bill, you see moving away from the strict bachelor's degree requirement and moving to equivalence, associate degree with additional training, alternative credentialing. We heard a lot of feedback from particularly communities of color that there were barriers in making sure we had culturally competent providers and just providing programs that could reach different communities. So this is definitely an improvement. This comes out of a variety of stakeholder conversations since last year to come up with this adjustment in the educational requirement, and I think you'll hear about that today. Also in the bill, you know, compensation, as I mentioned, is really, really important. And I think our goal is to get all of our early childhood educators to a different standard of education and also salary. But it's going to take some time to do that. And that's one of the things we heard. It's like people like Preschool Promise, but we have a long way to go until we can really start setting targets on salary. So what you have in the bill on page 3 is talking about guidelines instead of requirements and giving some flexibility to the early learning division. So within the program, we're trying to reflect what's actually out there in the workforce and in the environment right now. It'll change over time, and we need a little more flexibility in Preschool Promise as it relates to salary. But let's be clear. Improving compensation will reduce turnover. Improving compensation will create paths to professionalization and education that is good for the children in these different settings. So that's where we want to go. And this bill's not trying to take away from that trajectory. It's just saying what's the practical spot to be in right now as it relates to Preschool Promise. And then finally, Early Learning Division and the Early Learning Council are directed in this bill to evaluate. Let's really talk about salary and educational requirements. It's really kickstarted a very robust conversation about professional development, education, training, salary, compensation that I think is going to benefit us in the long run. So it's a kind of a compilation of things coming out of a lot of conversations, and I think you're going to hear some good testimony today of why we need this. And so I urge your support, look forward to the questions, and just thank you for taking up the bill.
So what questions do members have? Oh, come on, don't let her off that easy. So I have a question.
Sure, Mr. Chair.
So the section that's dealing on Section 3 that's dealing with the salary, and we changed from guidelines in that, and, mm-hmm. and I don't remember. So the original bill in that talked about the salary level with the bachelor's degree in that. So what does this do in relationship to those we've already hired versus those we might be hiring in the future?
Well, that's a very good question, and I might, in terms of existing programs, I would maybe leave that to the folks who will follow me. But I do think this will allow, as hopefully we continue to maintain the pilot projects in Preschool Promise and expand them, I think you'll open up the pool of programs that can participate with the changes in this bill. The other thing I would point out, too, we're not just talking about, we're trying to, this is a bigger conversation about not just Preschool Promise, but other preschool teachers. And that's one of the things that we hope will come out of the evaluation as well. You've heard a lot from Head Start, particularly about their salary needs. So this is not just a Preschool Promise discussion, but we should make sure that Preschool Promise is leading the way and pushing these discussions in a way that's practical and also really is getting us toward this quality system we want.
Thank you. Any other questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Sure.
Enjoy the rest of the testimony. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, so let's see. So we have 8 or 9 people who have signed up to testify in favor. So we'll start Eva. Is it Autumn and Angie? There's actually... We only have 3 chairs. If you all want to come up, or what do you want to do?
I can come up and move out of the way so
okay.
they can talk.
She might need a chair for 2, sir. I said you might need a chair for 2.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, maybe.
Almost, huh?
Almost.
Just state your name for the record.
Chair Lightly, Vice Chair Peluso, members of the committee. I'm Eva Ripito with AFSCME Council 75. Sorry, now I'm...
out of breath.
Like, usually I'm like turning red because I'm nervous. Now I'm turning red. So AFSCME Council 75 represents child care licensed in-home child care providers, also known as family child care, and we also have 3 Head Start locations in the state, one of which we represent non-teaching staff, and then 2 where we have teaching and non-teaching staff. I'm truly grateful for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2013, and also grateful for Speaker Kotek and her staff convening the work group, which I was able to participate in. The changes that are provided in House Bill 2013 are simple, but very important so that we can continue the conversations around raising the wages for our early learning educators and child care providers. And I think Speaker Kotek laid out all the changes. I would like to call attention to Sabi Velasco's written testimony. She was also planning on being here today, but had a family emergency that kept her from being able to make it. But she runs a Spanish program, dual language program in Beaverton, and is part of the Preschool Promise program. Is one of the providers who does not have a formal education and had... and had to hire somebody who did have a formal education and kind of struggled with getting that person trained because her formal education didn't really provide the necessary interactions that you get, you know, from being in a program and then receiving community trainings too. So having the provisions that are laid out in House Bill 2013 will allow for her to be the lead teacher in her own program going forward, should it pass. We're also appreciative around the flexibility and the guidelines for the lead teacher pay. For our Head Start provider, or for our Head Start teachers, when they heard about Preschool Promise being implemented, they said, why would one classroom get paid, one teacher in one classroom get paid more than I do when I've been doing this for years and have the same level of education? So this would allow for an adjustment in that to look at all of the teacher pay and then also include other staff in the location as well. Because there's high turnover in every level of Head Start and child care. So having the report look at all staff is... a good point too. And then of course allowing for the conversation on workforce wages to continue. And I think it's safe for me to say that all of my colleagues in advocacy in the room agree that we still have a lot of work to do in raising the wages of early learning, child care, and then also continuing on the conversations around what that access to child care and early learning and professional development looks like. I should say, too, that I've mentioned in other committees and numerous other meetings that that meeting the needs of our early learning and child care workforce and the demand for their services will take much more significant investment than what we currently are making in the state. And until we fund early learning and child care like we do kindergarten through college, affordability and accessibility for families and low pay for providers will continue to be an issue. So to make these kinds of investments, we'll need revenue. So I thank you for your time, and I welcome any questions.
Any questions for either? Doesn't look like it. Thanks for coming and testifying.
Sure.
We could always call you back, but no. Mm-hmm. So we have Autumn, David, Angie Lowe, and Josie Emmerich. Welcome.
I'm Chair Lively and co-chairs Hack and Peluso and members of the committee. My name is Autumn David. I'm a president for AFSCME, the local child care providers together. I'm a certified family child care provider in Salem and have been in business for 20 years. I have 12 preschool promised children, and I'm a step 10 on the Oregon Registry, and our program is a 5-star on SPARC, formerly the Quality Rating and Improvement System. 5 stars is the highest rating a child care facility can receive and has high standards of training for myself and my staff, parent engagement, and, of course, quality care in the children. First, I want to thank you for helping make Preschool Promise a reality. I've seen firsthand how this is benefiting our community and the children that would not be able to participate in preschool. When I was selected to become a Preschool Promise provider, I was honored. I have built my program from ground up over the last 20 years, and I'm proud of the program we have. When Preschool Promise was first starting, I attended meetings, and it was brought up in that the qualifications would be for the lead teacher to have a bachelor's degree. I advocated against this, as I knew this would keep many quality providers, including myself, from being the lead teachers in our own programs. Oregon has built a system called Oregon Registry, a professional development ladder for providers to show the step they are based on the hours and types of training. I'm a step 10, which is equivalent to the hours of training I would have taken to earn a bachelor's degree in the child care field. With the current requirements for Preschool Promise of having a bachelor's degree, I have hired a lead teacher instead of working as a lead teacher myself. accepting to participate in Preschool Promise, I have thought hard if it is worth my time and effort to go back to school for a bachelor's degree. At this time in my life, I do not think it's a wise choice. There's no funding for further education. There's no replacement of time. This would take away from my husband, my children, and now my grandchildren. Would the time be worth taken away from my child care program I have worked so hard to build? We work long hours, preparing curriculum and food, cleaning and doing administration work beyond our 13-hour work days. I have to think, what benefits would this really give me? I cannot think of any way this would benefit my program. I agree high standards are important and think the system of the Oregon Registry could work in guiding the requirements. I ask that you feel free to visit my program and to see how having a degree would benefit me at this time in my journey. I'm not opposed to having a degree and applaud those who do, but it is not something that will make my program better. I ask that you consider the changes this bill would make. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Chair Lively and Vice Chair Hackam-Peluso and our trusted committee. My name is Angie Lowe, and I'm the owner of Tiny Hands Specialized Child Care out in Staten. I'm a fully inclusive child care program. I have 20 years of working with these kids, all my experience, with an emphasis, again, on working with children and their families with special needs. My program allows all the children to access community-based programs such as Preschool Promise with regards to no, you know, disabilities, their needs, including those of allergies. We work with outside agencies to ensure that the children are receiving the highest quality of care and education. I just learned yesterday that I actually reached my 9-step in Oro, and this morning I received the phone call from Western Oregon that my program has become a 5-star.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No. That's good. That's a good thing. Nice.
You know, long hours. I'm here to support House Bill 213 and the changes that it will make to the preschool program regarding the bachelor's degree in the early education. I take great pride in my fully inclusive program and my ability to have a high-quality program that includes myself and my staff and our current levels of education. Both of my staff are working towards their Step 7 in their O, and I am currently enrolled in Ashworth College in their bachelor's program of early childhood development. The current amount of hours needed to run my quality program, along with the demands of Preschool Promise, have left me with very little time. I believe that the college education is not the only important attribute that makes a program quality. Knowledge and trainings do. College-level classes aren't easy to implement into our daily program needs, but community-based trainings generate towards the needs of our child care business and are easily transformed from our trainings into our program. Typical trainings are between 3 hours, and I can directly get those into my program. I can spend 50 hours on one of my classes and not have the same amount of knowledge. I believe that community-based trainings are more effective and will allow our time to be spent working with our children in our business, which would provide a higher quality and more effective program. Despite my time constraints, I am very glad to be a part of the preschool program. I am grateful for the opportunity to speak out about the needs of our early learning workforce. Child care providers work long, hard hours to achieve our quality programs, and we ask of the Early Learning Division to do studies and professional development, including all the child care, and not to limit it just to the preschool. Increasing the wages of all child care will continue to increase the quality and access to all children currently in care and in need of early learning experiences. We ask for these wages increases to continue our education that most of us pay out of our own pockets, to continue to provide nutritious meals, because some of the children don't get those otherwise. I'm asking that our wages be increased so that all children can have access to high-quality programs and to continue to support the families that rely on our preschool promise. I also would like to close with one last statement about the bachelor's in early childhood education. It does not equal a quality program, nor does it provide a safe and loving environment where children can grow and thrive. A highly trained provider that is paid appropriately does. Higher wages allows less employee turnover, which builds a stable foundation for love and trust in children while building relationships between our families and our community. I'd like to express my gratitude to the chair, vice chair, and the members of this committee today as we move forward with House Bill 2013 and invest in programs that build foundations for our children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Peluso, Vice Chair Heck, and members of the committee. My name is Josie Emmerich, and I run a certified family child care program. I'm a preschool promise provider in collaboration with the Early Learning Hub, Marion Polk Early Learning Hub. I also have an Early Head Start partnership through the Community Action Agency. I've been doing in-home child care for 10 years. I have a master's degree in early childhood inclusive education, curriculum, and education. I also have over 20 years of experience working with young children. I'm here to support Bill HB 2013 and the changes that it's going to make to the Preschool Promise program. The key to high-quality early education are interactions between children and teachers. And young children need caring, nurturing teachers who are committed to promoting attachment and rich learning experiences. Teachers must have specialized training, but this can come in many forms. I've had the opportunity to work alongside teachers that have bachelor's degree, that have associate's degree, and some that have just received community-based training. And I can honestly say that quality teaching comes in many different forms, and diverse experiences and backgrounds really provide a more rich programming for children. And that's why I'm here. holding a bachelor's degree doesn't necessarily guarantee quality, but neither does not having one not mean that they're not getting a good educational experience. This bill impacts my program because right now I have a hard time finding staff that's qualified to do substitute work. So I can't find people to sub for myself. I can't find people to sub for people when they're sick. And that really creates a stressful environment. It also creates, you know, provider overload and burnout. And it's a high turnover when everybody is stressed and trying to meet the needs of all the children. In addition, I'd like to express the importance of increasing teacher wages so that way children can receive a continuity of care, which is essential to their brain development and emotional security. Paying teachers professional wages removes barriers and makes things like investing in their own education more accessible. Providing professional pay creates a happier workforce, improves job satisfaction, and the quality of care that children receive. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for members of this panel? Thank you again for taking the time and good presentations. That's great. So I have four more. So since there's three seats, maybe I'll just call up two at a time. So Lisa Harnish and Ashley Oakley.
All right, so good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Peluso, and Vice Chair Hack. It is a pleasure to be in front of you again today on what is, I hope you know by now, one of my most favorite topics is Preschool Promise. So thank you very much for taking time to hear about this very important bill. That's the second time I've done that. For the record, my name is Lisa Harnish, and I'm the executive director for the Marion and Polk Early Learning Hub. Thank you very much. Preschool Promise, as you know, is an investment for families in quality environments and for the workforce. Preschool Promise has allowed us as a community and as a state to provide more access of a preschool promise or preschool experience to children and families to support them so that they can be more ready for kindergarten. It's also provided us the ability to have an increase in quality environments that can be supportive of families and children in a variety of different settings. It's also, and probably one of my most favorite topics, is it is allowing us to focus on workforce development of the early learning workforce. A highly qualified and trained workforce is an important crux of this work. In the initial language, the legislation asked for lead teachers to have a bachelor's as one of the demonstrations of quality. We recognize that quality comes in many forms and that workforce development is sometimes a very long road. The revised language provided in House Bill 2013 offers an inclusive pathway for professionals in the field of early learning and honors specialized training that may have come in other forms, while ensuring that the quality of instruction will be consistent with what we desire to see in our preschool classrooms. This language acknowledges and allows for cultural and language differences in our providers and the types of programs that are a part of the Preschool Promise landscape. This language will allow us to continue to be intentional with our work with around increasing quality instruction and elevating workforce development. In our community, we will continue to work tirelessly with our higher education partners to ensure that early learning pathways are available for early learning professionals to achieve their educational goals. This work is instrumental to our youngest learners and to the quality of the profession overall. We all have a goal that our preschool teachers be paid a wage that is commensurate with their educational background and experience. The change calling for salary guidelines is very much appreciated. Having a salary requirement for the higher pay has offered, while really good, and that's where we want to go, it's also offered us some unique challenges, particularly if we're working with organizations that may have salary requirements or bargain salary structures, and in some cases may have had unintended consequences negatively impacting staff morale when you have different pay levels for the same work amongst different classrooms. This will allow us to be able to work with providers to find a path to increase salaries, but do so in a way that will help us move the structures along. Thank you so much for your continued support and investment in Preschool Promise and the early learning system as a whole. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Cool. Good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Hack, and Vice Chair Peluso, and committee members. For the record, my name is Ashley Oakley, and I evaluate Head Start and early Head Start programs at the Native American Youth and Family Center, also known as NAYA Family Center. We have Head Start classrooms in both Portland and in Gresham, and although we agree with the goals and the high standards of quality care intended with Preschool Promise, the educational requirements are kind of being valued above experience and culture, and it's making it really difficult for us to hire teachers who can provide what we define as culturally specific care. Our early learning programs require teachers who understand our culture, and we need to have the ability to hire teachers who are aware of the historical trauma that our people have with institutions, especially around the school system. The low wages already create a barrier to employing parents, and when educational requirements are not on par with compensation, more barriers are created. If this amendment were to pass, it would allow our Head Start programs to better serve our students and families, as well as help out with greater and improved parent engagement. We must value culture as an integral part of a child's development, and we need to recognize the impact that culturally specific learning environments can have on student success. Thank you very much for taking the time to hear about the Native American Youth and Family Center's ability to provide culturally specific early learning in the light of Preschool Promise.
Thank you. Any questions for members of this panel? Thank you, both of you, for testifying. And I have two more on the list, Danielle and Soren.
Good, Excuse me. Good afternoon. My name is Danielle Pacifico-Kogan, and I am the Communications Director for the Children's Institute. And I'm here today to ask for your support for HB 2013, in particular the language changes. And the reason that I ask for the support is that Speaker Kotek took it upon herself to create a working group that actually was going to address the issues that are very significant for our communities, not only communities of color, but English language learners, as well as rural communities who don't have the means and the wherewithal and actually the population to actually have a body of workers who can also, who can have bachelor's degrees and other degrees as well to create an environment where children are getting the best education possible. So we believe at the Children's Institute that these changes are actually practical, they're relevant, and they actually allow educators who provide high quality services already to continue to provide those services to our most vulnerable children. And we need high quality educators who have experience, who have education, and who are able to get more practical experience in education in our classrooms, because children at this point in life, between 0 to 5, are at their greatest period of brain development, and we need the right people in the classrooms to work with them. And that's why we hope you support the proposed changes to HB 2013. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and members of the committee. My name is Soren Metzger, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2013 and on behalf of the Oregon School Employees Association, representing Head Start workers in the Clackamas County Children's Commission, Lane County Head Start, Neighborhood Impact, and the Mount Hood Community College Head Start Program. Now, fortunately, I was last on the list, so a lot of the things that I wanted to say have already been said, so I'll keep it short and sweet. I would say my understanding of the preschool promise is that it's very much in its infancy, and I think fixes early on are important and necessary. House Bill 2013 addresses the feedback that I've received on this program thus far. Specifically, House Bill 2013 allows all high quality candidates to apply and work as lead teachers in the Preschool Promise program. I think this bill does a really good job of recognizing that quality is not synonymous with a bachelor's degree, but that experience, training, and certifications with an associate's degree can also qualify educators as highly trained and qualified for lead teacher positions in the Preschool Promise program. Also, I really appreciate that House Bill 2013 requires an evaluation of early learning educator salaries as it relates to retention by the Early Learning Division, and will hopefully lead to a much needed investment. I would like to just conclude with another piece of the evaluation, which I really appreciate, is that it will identify methods for financing early learning programs to ensure all eligible families are able to participate in a high-quality preschool program. So according to some information that was made available to me by the Oregon Head Starts Association, currently there are about 12,266, children enrolled in the Oregon pre-kindergarten program, while 59.3% of those children eligible for Head Start are while only 59.3% of eligible children are being served, which means that there's about 1,700 students or children, on the wait list. So OSEA supports funding levels sufficient to ensure that all eligible children may participate in Oregon pre-kindergarten programs. So with that, OSEA all around thinks that HB 2013 is a great bill, and we urge your support.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions for any member of this panel?
Yes, please.
Yes. Representative Peluso.
Because I think you were the last, right?
Oh, so you get the question.
Well, no, actually, because I want to address everybody who presented. So I was on the education committee last session, and I sit on a school board, and we frequently talk about the different ways of pathways for learning for our students. And for me, it always feels focused on middle schoolers and high schoolers. So based on the really good testimony today, I'm going to include starting with early childhood to make the path the right way and the right distance. And I appreciate folks coming from their work to come and talk about this. It is super, super important and very well done. So thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would just echo Representative Peluso's remarks. You all did well, and it was very educational and informative besides, so it was a great conversation, and we look forward to working on the bill.
Yeah.
So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2013. Now we're going to move on to an informational hearing. So I'm going to open the informational hearing on pathways for the early learning workforce. And David, yes. Ben. Angie. Okay. Welcome.
Chair Lively, committee members, for the record, I'm David Mandel, Acting Early Learning System Director, and I actually feel like the entire public hearing that you just had on House Bill 2013 is really just the perfect preamble for the presentation that we're going to have today. As I think was highlighted in the discussion, preschool promise, by having the BA requirement, put the spotlight on how challenging it is for folks who are working in the early learning workforce to actually access those pathways to a degree. And I think it's really really exciting that we're also thinking about ways of creating some more flexibility. But in doing so, I also want to make sure that we don't lose the attention on what are those pathways and how do we make those pathways really meaningful for people who are working full-time jobs, whose English may be a secondary language, who may not have had experiences with higher education institutions before. So I'm really excited to be part of this panel. We know for those in the early learning workforce who are interested in a BA, that really goes through community college, through an AA, rather than being a substitute for that. And so to be able to have Ben Cannon here to talk about some of the work that we're able to do, we have the potential to partner with to really make those pathways work for the workforce is really exciting. I'm also really pleased to be sitting here with my colleague Margie McNabb to talk about two projects that were funded in 2013 as part of the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. And I'll really let her dive into them in detail, but I think what's really exciting is I think you all know what the barriers are for, we've talked about that before, for the early learning workforce and a workforce that really has tremendous diversity as an asset to access those pathways. But what's really exciting is to be able to show what can happen. And when you do a little bit of work and investment to remove some of those barriers and how we, there are the folks in the field who really want to take advantage of those opportunities and are able to do that when we make that possible. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Ben.
Thanks, David. For the record, Ben Cannon. I'm Executive Director for the state's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'm very glad to have the opportunity, I think for the first time, to be in the Early Childhood Committee and to be thinking about and working on the beginning of the education continuum, which has so much importance for success later on. Of course, today we're focused on the workforce issues, and my role is primarily in just a few slides to provide some data and information about what exists with respect to certificate and degree pathways within Oregon's public higher education system today. So that's what my slides attempt to do. I have a bit of additional information that's not in the presentation related to wages for graduates from our early childhood related certificate and degree program. So I'm happy to touch on that as well and then to respond to any of your questions. So let me start out just with our community college programs. And this is just a snapshot of what exists today at Oregon's community colleges. As you see from the slide, 14 of the 17 Oregon community colleges offer programs in early childhood education. And the certificates or degrees available to students take different forms. And so we've broken them down here based largely on type and time. So there are 30 opportunities for students or 30 different ways that students can earn less than 1 year certificates of completion. So these may be a term or a couple of term. 24 of those are stackable, so they represent momentum points. Typically they're part of a 1 year or even 2 year program, but they allow a student to earn a certificate before they've completed that 1 or 2 year program. We have 11 full-on one-year certificates of completion, and then you see finally the 15 applied associate's degrees, which are typically 2 years of full-time study or more, and broken them down by type. So that's simply what exists today at Oregon Community Colleges. Our public universities, as you know, there are seven public universities in the state of Oregon, five of which offer baccalaureate, bachelor's degree programs in early childhood education. You see them listed here. They have different emphases and specialties and different requirements. In addition to the programs that are described here at Eastern and Portland State, Southern Oregon, University of Oregon, and Western, I did want to note the fact that Portland State University also houses the Oregon Registry, which you're well aware of, but that is a service that that university provides in addition to the major that they offer for students in child and family studies. I'm going to turn a little bit to the data about how many students and degrees, how many students are participating and degrees are awarded in these programs. I just want to note on the baccalaureate side a little bit of sort of classification issues. Oregon Public University's award, as it turns out, relatively few bachelor's degrees classified under the four codes. These are common standard national codes for categorizing different types of degrees. So that's I'll present that data in a moment, but I'll combine it with students who are earning degrees in a more general education, under a more general education code, but with the early childhood teacher education specialty. So I'm combining those categories, the four explicit early childhood ones that are described at the top of this slide, as well as students who earn a general education degree, but with the particular early childhood specialty. And those numbers are here. So we've combined them all, and you can see on the right-hand column the grand total by year of students earning either bachelor's degree or master's or higher since 2010 and through the 2014-15 year at any of our five public universities that offer bachelor's or master's degrees. So I know little, just enough about this topic to know that I have little to offer in the way of analysis or perspective. In other words, I don't know very much. So take these numbers. I don't have an interpretation or a gloss on these. They are what they are, that in 2014-15, 402 students earned bachelor's or master's degrees in early childhood-related fields at Oregon public universities. I don't have a slide, but I do have data on comparable numbers from our community colleges for certificate and 1 and 2 year degree totals. And interestingly, they're not higher. In fact, they're slightly lower. So in 2015-16, the most recent year for which we have data, we show 274 awards in either certificates or associate's degrees at Oregon community colleges. Finally, as I mentioned, I would touch on some of the earnings data, and there are a lot of caveats associated with earnings data because we don't track it in a particularly tight way. But what we are able to do is work with the Department of Employment and match the unemployment insurance-related wage records. So for students who stay in state, graduates who stay in state and are working at an employer that participates in that system, and there are certain exceptions, but they're, if they're in state and they're in the UI system, we can match their record with their higher education record, the record of whether they attended a Oregon Community College or public university, and we know what degree or certificate they earn. So we can begin to measure and get a sense of how these degrees or certificates are rewarded in the work in the labor market. And so, for example, in 2014-15, those 402 graduates of bachelor's degree programs at Oregon public universities, if they have a wage record with after a year in our unemployment insurance system, their average annual earnings were $37,000. For a certificate earner, again, same conditions. They have to have a wage record. If they have a wage record in the system, we show in 2014-15 the sort of 18,000 seems to be I'm looking at several years of data, but 18,000 seems to be about right and similar for an associate's degree. So that gives you a sense.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. Do you have the data on male, female, Latino? Do we have any demographic type data on folks?
Representative Hack. Chair Lively, I don't have that in front of me, but I believe it would be possible for us to look within our system and disaggregate the information either by wage or degree attainment. Which are you interested in looking at that wage data by gender or race, ethnicity?
I want to see it all.
We'll do our best.
I don't know how cumbersome that is, but certainly I would say wage, the disparity in wage. I'd like to also know, though, how many, the gender.
How many men go into
the field? How many men go into the field?
Also, I just want to add, Chair Lively, Representative Hack, we have also an additional data source from the Oregon Registry Online, folks who are self-reporting in the field that also can give us another look at the same workforce and have some information that we can share with you that has information on gender and ethnicity and self-reporting on degrees and salary. Will be no surprise, it is overwhelmingly majority female workforce.
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, I think the ethnicity piece is also really important,
yes.
So I don't want to say I'm just interested in the male-female version. I think ethnicity also needs to be addressed. So if we can have that, I think that would be important to all of us, too. I don't want to speak for everybody, but I would assume I think that's really important.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. It's great to see my former state representative here. So I'm also curious about how many hours that is, because 18,000 after having gotten an associate's degree is really depressing. And I know I love that we're working on developing curriculum and access to curriculum and culturally responsive and things like that, but certainly that's a very strong cry out for the wage ladder, a solid wage ladder to go in place.
Representative Kenny Geyer, Representative Lively. I don't have that data in front of me, but again, I think that's something we can at least attempt to discern from the UI data in a follow-up request.
Thank you.
So, Ben, I have a question. So part of what we've heard in these conversations is kind of the barriers to being able to get additional training in that. And when I noticed your slide, especially on the slide on institution higher education, only two of them had online opportunities. And this is something I've heard conversations about for I can't tell you how long we've talked about that. But it doesn't seem like we've made, but it seems to me online provides overcomes some of the barriers that sometimes comes with being able to get the education. So is there progress being made? Is there an agenda that helps to do more of that? Help me understand, especially from the institutions of higher education, where all that's going.
Representative Lively, members of the committee, I can't speak to specifically trends or activities in early childhood-related programs specifically, but generally in higher education, it will come, I think, as no surprise to this committee that institutions are quite aggressively pursuing the development of fully online or partially online programs in order to create more options for students, particularly working students, first-generation students, other students for whom traditional, four-year place-based education is not accessible and it's not practical. So I would be surprised if these opportunities weren't growing. However, they may not be growing quickly enough mm-hmm. to meet the need, certainly something we would be interested in exploring with our partners at the Early Learning Division as well as the legislature.
Sure. Thank you. Any other questions have been? No, we'll move on.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Chair Lively, Co-Chair Peluso and Hack, and members of the committee. I'm Margie McNabb, and I'm with the Early Learning Division. I'm a professional development specialist, and I'm really grateful to be here to talk about one of my favorite subjects. And can everyone hear me okay? Okay, just want to make sure I have that. And it's about the Early Learning Professional Development Consortium project. And as I go through this, I think some of the questions that were asked may be answered based on what's actually happening in the field. So back in 2013, House Bill 3233 established the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning, and that network then established a strategic investment fund, and that strategic investment fund was really focused on the advancement of the profession. We were able to carve out a little bit of money for the early learning workforce and professional development of the early learning workforce.
So the grant initiative was called the Early Learning Professional Development Consortium, really focused on a lot of partners supporting professional development. It was $400,000 that was set aside, and seven grantees, applicants, applied for this funding. Two were awarded. The focus was definitely on developing higher educational pathways for our early learning care and education professionals, so those who are already working, already part of child care provider profession. And it's to obtain college credits, certificates, and degrees in early childhood education. The other part of this, a major focus of this project, was to create flexible offerings to reach, to obtain credits and to obtain higher education degrees that really met their needs. That we call them career to college workforce. And as you heard in earlier testimony, those who are actually working that are the ones that are targeted for these funds, but they work long hours and often do not have the money, and the time that they have off is very precious. So this was to also provide flexible offerings to meet their needs and help cover the cost of tuition, fees, books, and other things they may need, such as transportation. So two grants were awarded, and as you can see, it was actually, these two grants covered a third of the state. So Central Oregon, Partners in Practice, and the counties were Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson. And then Southern Oregon, Early Learning Professional Development, and the counties were Coos, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Klamath, and Lake. So a little bit about the key components, and then we're going to talk more about what the results were and then specifically the activities in each of these projects so you can see how it all played out. But the key components, I wanted to pull these out because they align with state research, which I know you've heard Bobby Weber's research, as well as national research. The Institute of Medicine and National Research Council did a study a couple of years ago. And it was Transforming the Workforce for Children Birth Through Age 8, a Unifying Foundation. And they came up with 13 recommendations. And these projects really encompassed many of these recommendations. So kind of breaking it down into three categories, a few of the recommendations were about comprehensive pathways, pathways where wherever an early learning professional enters, they are able to go and obtain their degrees. Comprehensive, too, so where the courses are relevant. There are ways that they can share their education and their history across institutions, across colleges. There are four-term courses that are easily accessible. And then another aspect of these projects is universities. So it was specifically Southern Oregon University offered university-level credit and weekend workshops. So they were trainings, and early learning professionals could get college credit attending those trainings. And Southern Oregon University actually traveled around to different communities to offer this. Also professional learning supports, and I'm sure you've heard the research about the importance of relationships and supporting our early learning professionals in going through obtaining their higher education and trainings. So that includes, these supports include those transferable credits, being able to go where they're portable and stackable, as Ben was discussing as well, scholarships, cohorts, so those groups that really stay together and work together through their pathways, and then coaches, mentors, and navigators that offer that professional development that's relationship-based. And then diversity strategies. A big key and focus on these projects was really to support the barriers that those who are culturally diverse have trying to obtain higher education. So we had Spanish cohorts where all content was taught in Spanish, in the home language. Bilingual peer navigators, as well as the flexible class offerings that were offered, such as at Warm Springs and at other communities that were in their home areas, and then intentional outreach to underrepresented providers, and then of course early childhood education that was offered vocational English as a second language. So that was a big focus of these, and it really encompassed those recommendations from the national research. So specific to our projects, the innovative practices really supported the amazing success that happened in just 1 year. There were coaches in every one of the projects and in every one of the community colleges that participated. Peer mentors. The peer mentors were those who were actually in the programs themselves and had been in there for a while and knew the story about being a child care provider, working 60 hours a week, going back to school and trying to balance family life and school and being able to really help support. Scholarships, stipends, and waived fees. Community colleges actually waived fees for our early learning professionals so that they did not have to go through a fee every time they started a class, they entered a class. Collaboration among partners. You'll see the partners that were involved, but they were involved a lot of community-based organizations. Cohorts, and then also the portfolios that transferred among the institutions so students could tell their story once, which is always a plus. Also established conferences. I know you heard from some of the testimony that the community-based trainings that are in place, being able to attend those or attend conferences and get college credit that then articulates to a degree. Face-to-face orientation for online instruction. So as the online classes were developed, many providers did not necessarily know how to navigate an online system, so being able to provide an opportunity for them to come together and learn that. And then, as I mentioned earlier, Southern Oregon University's weekend traveling workshops, and then classes offered in home communities, home languages, and at, as we were saying, the career to college times. The other thing, too, is that in some of the communities, dual credit coursework and ECE was strengthened and enhanced in high schools to make a smooth and seamless transition to higher education. So in just 1 year, $400,000 did this. And it involved 8 post-secondary institutions. So in Southern Oregon, it was Rogue Community College, Southwest Oregon Community College, Umpqua Community College, and Klamath Community College. And then in Central Oregon, it was Central Oregon Community College. And then Southern Oregon University, University of Oregon, Cascades, and Oregon State University. I think that's right. And so 12 CBOs, meaning the Child Care Resource and Referral Organizations, Head Starts, OCDC, also ESDs were involved, early learning hubs, those that were established in the communities, and a regional achievement compact in Central Oregon, and the Warm Springs Tribe. So 917 of our child care providers went through this project. There were over 3,000 ECE credits earned, 76 achieved certificates, 31 completed degrees, and those were AA degrees. And keep in mind that this was just 1 year, so this gave momentum for those who were already moving through and kind of gave them that extra push. And over 400, and that number is probably higher now, I am reporting on the data for 2014-2015, professionals advanced on the Oregon Registry. So the cohorts were offered in Brookings, Coos Bay, Medford, and Roseburg. 43 of them were 43 Spanish-speaking early learning professionals attended. An interesting point, and Rogue in Medford, 10 of those 22 who attended are now preschool promise providers. So they have advanced and moved to getting their ability to be preschool promise providers. And then, as I mentioned earlier, there's Southern Oregon University workshops. You can see where SOU went. And then 318 early learning professionals attended those workshops, and they had the option to obtain college credit if they chose to. If not, they certainly had professional development hours towards their steps on the registry.
Representative Hack, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Chair. So out of the 400,000 awarded, could you remind me how many were granted?
Two.
So two were granted. How many had applied?
Seven
applied.
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure. So in looking at where the cohorts, where the work was done, is that based on the two that were given the money?
Representative Hack, yes, that's correct. And I'll show you. I'm going to break that down in a couple more slides.
Can I have another follow-up?
Sure.
So were demographics... Mm. it at play in the decision making for the two that were awarded?
Representative Hack, Chair Lively, that's a great question. I was not part of that process of choosing. We had a pretty extensive process, evaluation committees. I stepped in at the moment they were awarded. However, I could get that information. We have a lot of raw data for that.
Can I have another one? Thank you. I think it would. I would be interested in seeing the rubric that was used in determining how those dollars were allocated, simply because I think out of that many that applied and we only had two, and just at glance, it looks like it is fairly narrow in demographic across the state. So I'd like to see how the decision was made. I mean, I don't need to see the applications, but I'd like to see how the decision was made, what they used as far as a rubric to determine how they only got two out of the number that applied, and the other, just the lack of diversity in not having it span across our state, given the number of hubs that we have, the number of amount participating, the need. I would have liked to have seen $400,000 go a little farther than just two. So I'd just like to, if we could have that information, I'd love to take a look at that.
Chair Lively, Representative Hack, I will definitely get that to you. I'll get it to David.
Thank you.
Pass that on to you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. So let's go ahead and move to the demographics. This breaks it down a little bit more. So you can see of the students, the early learning professionals, this is the breakdown of the race and ethnicity. And also the childcare types. So keeping in mind that these were career to college, they're caring for children. So we have registered family at 111, certified family 82, center 410, and exempt we had 18. And the other ECE professionals really counted a variety. Some were planning to go into it, but also several of them were working at centers or at Head Starts. So that include they were in the profession and they were already providing care for children. And also just to note that what was reported as far as first-generation college students was 240 of the 917. However, we have a hunch not everyone reported that, because we're quite sure that this population was more than 240 first-generation college students. So this breaks it down according to the regions a little bit more and what was done. So Central Oregon's partners in practice had about 150,000 of the 400,000. And you can see the partners that were involved. They're all listed there. Their target was 90 students, but you can see they served 125 in that year. And they were able to award two certificates and finish 11 degrees. Again, those were AA degrees. The classes, as I had mentioned earlier, were offered in different regions. And here they offered in Bend, Redmond, Warm Springs, and Madras. And they specifically reached out to Spanish-speaking and Native American early learning professionals. And we do have a video of this particular project, and it's very moving to listen to. But one story that really stood out for me was a child care provider who had not been in school for 25 years. She graduated from high school 25 years ago, and she started on this pathway in a cohort, and she was part of the Warm Springs group. And she said that it was so amazing to come to things that she'd been doing for 25 years with kids, such as playing with Play-Doh, and realizing, oh, we're not just playing with Play-Doh. We're actually learning fine motor, and we're preparing for kindergarten and what's happening with the brain. And so she's applying it right away as she's working.
I think it was 3233.
And then Southern Oregon received 250,000 of the 400,000. And you can see the partners involved there. They had all the child care resource and referral organizations, every early learning hub that was established. South Coast wasn't established yet, that early learning hub, as well as Head Starts and OCDC. Their target was 517 students, and they had ended up serving 792. And you can see the number of certificates and degrees that were completed, as well as the numbers of providers moving up the Oregon registry. So the professional development progress, and so when we think about pathways, this was pretty, in just 1 year, what was able to happen with these strategic investments. So increasing a step on the registry over 400, and as I said, I'm sure there's more. Achieved a star rating in Spark, 168, and again, we certainly have more, especially with our preschool promise providers. The number of credits earned and degrees and certificates completed. Just a note, the pictures in here are, except for a couple of stock pictures, are all from the projects themselves. Like, for example, this one's from Bend. Of course, we all have permission. But these are just some testimonies in the next couple of slides that I wanted to share with you. And you can see how this really supported these early learning professionals get on their pathway and support quality care in their programs. So are there any questions?
I have another one.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Could you tell me what bill number that was? Again, I missed it that did the $400,000 allotment.
Yes, Vice Chair Hack, that is House Bill 3233 in 2013.
13,
yeah.
Great, thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Okay, thank you so much for your presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the portfolio. And can you explain it a little bit more, and forgive me if I missed some of the detail. The electronic portfolio, I guess, is the way that they carry their transcript?
Yes, Representative Bynum, that is how it works. So across the southern tier, the four community colleges, they were able to set up e-portfolios. So the students could take a class. They worked out their schedules collaborating. They could take a class, and their portfolio just transferred. And so if someone from Rogue chose a class in Southwest because they needed it and Rogue wasn't offering it, they could take it online and their e-portfolio carried their information.
Okay, a follow-up?
Go ahead.
So then my secondary question is for Mr. Cannon. So in the higher ed committee, we're trying to deal with high school students transferring and collecting their credits and not losing them. And so I was wondering if that opportunity to have a portfolio so that the high school students, when they get ready to graduate and are entering, if that portfolio concept is available to them, because we know high school kids lose everything. So.
Representative Bynum, Chair Lively, it's a great question and probably worthy of further consideration and exploration by the Higher Ed Committee. The short answer is no. There does not exist a sort of electronic porthole for high school students matriculating in Oregon colleges and universities. And in fact, the process of sort of transferring credits and even reviewing high school, non-college credit-bearing courses, but reviewing a high school transcript by the colleges and universities is pretty laborious and time-intensive. So I think it's a topic worth exploring, and we'd be happy to provide more information.
Okay, just one more follow-up.
Sure, go ahead.
So if I can clarify, what I understand the problem to be is when the high school students have taken college-level classes, and if they move, translating those, well, consolidating them, maybe they've taken them in two or three community colleges, applying them to the high school transcript, and then taking them to their final community college or four-year college of choice, that's the hardship for the high schools.
Representative Bynum, Chair Lively, I think you're in the right arena. It's a little bit slightly different. So for a student matriculating at, say, Oregon State University, so starting out at OSU, who's taken a recent high school graduate who has credit that they earned through Portland Community College or Western Oregon University, for example, the transcript that they, depending on the type of credit they earn, but typically a dual credit, the transcript will be, the credit will be transcribed on a Western Oregon University or Portland Community College transcript, and as well as the high school transcript. But the challenge could be in shipping that PCC transcript to OSU and having that all line up. There's an additional challenge in getting the high school transcript, which may be important not even for the college credit that it shows having been earned, but the high school credit that is helps validate a student's level of readiness, for example, for college level work. So it's a, like everything we do, it's a complicated set of issues, but again, we'd be happy to explore it with you in further detail.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
I just have one question, and this committee has heard this before, but are you doing anything to help develop a substitute pool model for childcare? So not a curriculum issue, it's a structural issue, but it's a huge impact on the workforce.
Yeah. Representative Kenny Geyer, Chair Lively, that's a great question, and it is something we have been consistently looking at in the Early Learning Division, specifically our Quality Improvement and Professional Development team. We are looking at different opportunities to build that. There's definitely some work that would need to be done because we then get into licensing and ensuring that there's a criminal background check. There's everything, anyone who's caring for children, that's covered. So it's definitely on our radar, and it is something we know is a huge issue.
Thank you.
So I have a question, and it might be something that you want to provide information later, but when I looked at the slides, and so we talked about this pilot, $400,000, and what I noticed there was $79,000 or $80,000 in each one that went to scholarships and or tuition fees. Since I serve on the budget committee, I guess I'm kind of curious, because we're going to be looking at how we get more funds, and I'm kind of curious the cost overall and where the money, how the money was spent in order to get these results. I think the results are tremendous, don't get me wrong, but I'm trying to understand, especially want to do more of this, then what are those cost drivers that came out of that versus what we were just spending to do scholarships or tuition?
Chair Lively, another really great question, and one that we talk about a lot, and in fact, we have one of the school folks here, and she would probably gladly say, well, actually, a lot of that money came from tuitions being, or fees being waived, and, you know, so, and in all honesty, also part of my work right now is I'm really pulling that apart,
Okay. Looking
at a couple of different things, the readiness assessment of each college and each community, what allowed them to do this within create such momentum that we were able to reach so many people and get these results, as well as what were the real costs, because there's a lot of blending and braiding, if you will.
Sure.
So, that is something that I am working on and will be providing David and Don.
Great. Thank you very much. Any other questions for this panel? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I believe we have three more people, Dr. Andrew Garland-Forshee, Lori Potts, and R. Taylor. Let's see, I think.
Good afternoon, welcome. Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew Garland-Forshee from the Department of Early Education and Family Studies at Portland Community College. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to the committee about Oregon's early learning workforce and the critical role that the community college plays in the development and the education of these practitioners. First, we wish to thank the Oregon Community College Association, as well as our respective college presidents and boards, for supporting our collective work across the state and in our colleges. The three of us are here today to represent early education programs from the community colleges in Oregon. My colleagues will introduce themselves as they address you. So, what we know about the workforce today from the Oregon Early Learning Workforce Report developed by the Oregon Center for Career Development at Portland State University and the Oregon Child Care Research Partnership through Oregon State University is that the early education workforce is a complex constellation of both rural and urban educators, not only Head Start and early Head Start educators, but also licensed and registered family home providers, small business owners, exempt providers, family, friends, and neighbor care, private preschool, home visiting programs, and center-based care. 52% of the workforce does not have a completed associate or bachelor's degree, And there was a 40% turnover in the workforce between 2012 and 2014. As community colleges, we know our communities best, and we know how to prepare our students and create a skilled workforce for Oregon's children. We also know the barriers that prevent students from certificate and or degree completion. Number one, time. Because demand for early educators to enter the workforce before their training is complete is there, the majority of our students are employed in the workforce while they're attending college. This means part-time attendance, resulting in approximately 5 years required to complete an associate's degree. This time increases substantially for those who arrive at the program speaking a language other than English, or for those requiring general education support before even taking early childhood education coursework. Advising support. Working full-time, managing family and school, it's a huge undertaking. Students are more likely to successfully transition into school and complete certificates and degrees when someone supports them through it. Having someone at the community college level to support and coach students is essential to student success and completion. Three, clear pathways. The inconsistency of seamless and clear pathways into universities is an ongoing challenge. There aren't enough options across the state. We need clear pathways with no loss of credit or time for our students. Transferability from community colleges to universities is key to developing and sustaining a well-trained workforce. Four, compensation. Early educators continue to lack a sustainable family living wage, and this is illustrated in your handout. This is directly linked to the high rate of turnover in the workforce. Thus, it is important for early educators to have little to no student debt when they complete their training. Chair Lively, members of the committee, community colleges are the gateway into the culture of higher education. Community colleges are the place in Oregon where early childhood education is taught and presented effectively to the current early education workforce. Thank you. And we'd like to hold questions until we're all done presenting, if that's okay.
That's good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So thank you, Chair Lively and Vice Chair Peluso and Hack, for having us here today. For the record, I am Lori Potts from Southwestern Oregon Community College. Southwestern Oregon Community College is located in Representative Brock Smith's district, and we acknowledge him as one of our alumni. So
thank
he's
you.
Been there. That's great. As you can see on your handout, there was a map on there that our community college system programs reach across the state to access rural and urban populations. During the past 15 years, our colleagues in the community college system, along with some of our university and statewide partners, have been moving this work forward through a number of partnerships that you can review on the provided handouts, beginning with the Grand Articulation Summit and inclusive of the Oregon Career Pathway Certificate of Completion. The list is reflective of ongoing work. It's not inclusive of all the work, but it is a representative of it, that brings partners together from across the state to identify needs and barriers and to assist in creating areas of curriculum and program alignment coupled with supports for early education workforce. I also like to note that collectively, all of the programs in Oregon that have early childhood programs, we do offer coursework credit for Step 7 on the Oregon Registry so that people can have that jump start in. And also for CDAs. That's a little side note. So from these opportunities that you see on your handout, these work groups, opportunities that springs action. Through these venues, partnerships, projects, and work groups, many innovative and responsive projects have rolled forward to benefit the early education workforce. And a number of these projects are also included in your handout. And again, please note that the list is not intended to be inclusive of all the work that's being done in the community colleges, but it is a snapshot that represents some of the powerful work that's being done across the state in the community colleges. You may note, as you review the list of projects at each college, that there are similarities and differences in the implemented strategies. Our community colleges represent the urban and rural populations and needs throughout Oregon. In both our urban and rural regions, the need to improve quality and to maintain affordability for students and work towards completion of certificates and degrees is consistent, while the strategies implemented to address those needs may vary within our system based on our populations. So we hope that as you can see, as you review the many projects in your handout, the community colleges of Oregon are aware of the needs of the workforce and have collectively been innovative and responsive at every opportunity that we've been given. Most of our innovative strategies and projects have been funded through grants and one-time opportunity funding that we have leveraged to the fullest extent. These funding opportunities come in waves, causing an ebb and flow of available resources over the years. We are incredibly nimble and resourceful. When the funding tide is flowing, we are quick to respond. And when the funding ebbs, we take stock of our resources and continue on supporting our students. Our students are many of the workforce of early educators across the state of Oregon. The community college early childhood education programs in Oregon collectively are all invested in developing a workforce to ensure quality and early learning experiences for Oregon's rural and urban children. Consortium and collaborative projects have allowed us to shift our way of thinking of our students. They are not students of only one community college or another. They are all of our students. We do not see each other as competitors, but as partners to completion and success in the early education workforce development. Supported, and at times limited, by the resources that we have at hand, we can and do, to the best of our ability, prepare and educate the future teachers of Oregon's children so that all children may have equal access and opportunities to reach their potentials.
Thank you.
Chair Lively and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Robin Taylor, and I am the dean of several career and technical education programs at Chemeketa Community College, including early childhood education. Many of the initiatives you have heard described throughout the testimony today have been funded through short-term grants that eventually come to an end. This creates a cycle of program development, student recruitment, and ongoing work that diverts time and energy away from the work at hand, which is educating this workforce. We need funding for sustainable long-term solutions. Solutions and funding that will support students in completing their associate degrees at community colleges. We know what this means. Funding for cohort models, advisors and coaches, tuition waivers and supplements, resources for textbooks, and substitutes that allow working providers to complete practicum requirements. We know that this requires solutions that will move students towards the bachelor's degree quickly and efficiently. This means support for true 2+2 models, 2 years at the community college, 2 years at the university, support for the applied baccalaureate concept, and even 3+1 models, 3 years at the community college, 1 year at the university. We need models that acknowledge that these students in the early childhood workforce need the associate's degree on their pathway to a potential bachelor's degree. We also need solutions that will allow students to take online courses at any Oregon community college and transfer those credits easily. This is particularly important for our rural students who may not have access to as many courses throughout a year. This means supporting the infrastructure that would allow transfer of online courses between rural and urban Oregon community colleges without impact on a student's financial aid. Across the state, community college early childhood education programs have proven, and I think you've heard today, we're adept at responding to the needs of the workforce, even when we just get the littlest bit of funding. What we need now is an investment in our initiatives and infrastructure, dollars that can directly impact those in the workforce. We have shown Oregon repeatedly that we can and will move this workforce forward. We ask Oregon and you to make a commitment to its future by investing in those who invest their lives and time in our incredibly vulnerable and valuable resource, our children. We thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee, for this opportunity to be here and speak to you, and we're more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. What questions do members have? So I have a couple. So you talked about grants, and so I'm trying to understand kind of the growth of these programs, the expansion of it, because the programs have existed in community colleges for some time. And so the need for the grants or that is to be able to add components to it that to make the program. Is that what I'm understanding is going on?
Chair Lively, let me use one of the examples, and really probably almost all of the examples on the list, but I'll use the current one at Chemeketa Community College. We are really excited to be serving 26 students in a cohort-based model. Right now, they're coming every Saturday, every Friday night. I've heard they're studying their textbooks at Walmart in the Walmart parking lot so they can be away from children. But the way that we were able to do that, we had great partnership from our hub and our to get those students to us, but through a small Career Pathways dollars grant, we were able to reduce the tuition.
Oh, okay.
So the way that these grants work is to somehow offset what the student brings. And those students are paying 50% of our normal tuition, mm-hmm. but they don't have the money to pay for full tuition. So all of these grants, they generally are funding the instruction or the textbook or the substitute for those
possible.
Students.
Sure. And you mentioned something about about the student aid, and there might be some jeopardy of the student aid depending on how they're taking the classes?
Yes. Chair Lively, that what can happen is a student needs to be enrolled to a certain level of credits. And we have had, and my colleague Lori could speak more to what we've had in the past, but if a student enrolls at one college but then goes over here to take one class, they may not be eligible for their full financial aid for that.
So may I speak to that?
Sure.
Okay. Chair Lively and members of the committee, in the past there was a system that was known as OCDELA, and it was Oregon Community College Distance Learning Association. And so how that worked was that when a student did attend, we'll use an example because it happened often. A student attended Southwestern when we have limited coursework because of our rural nature and smaller, and they needed a course that was offered at Chemeketa, who was the big major partner in OCDELA. So our students would have their financial aid through Southwestern as their home college, but when they took their course at Chemeketa, financial aid treated it as if it was from Southwestern. So it was internal. The colleges would trade. One would get FTE, one would get tuition. The student didn't have to be involved in that, and for financial aid purposes, they could maintain their full-time status as a student. So there's kind of a workaround happening in the state right now called Genius.
Mm-hmm.
People are trying to put that together, but the Genius system doesn't speak to all of our systems. So students are at a loss.
Fascinating. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for the financial aid part for a student, when we looked at the wages, it was about $26,000. So is there an assumption, can I make an assumption that there's more family income for that student and that the students wouldn't necessarily qualify for, like, our Oregon Opportunity funds or any type of support that way? Or do they age out? I don't quite know. I know we have that support, but...
So, Chair Lively, Representative Bynum, I would say that we probably can't necessarily make that assumption because our student population is really broad.
Okay.
Some of our students are single parents. That is their income. That's what it is. And some may qualify for something else. We really work diligently with students to try to help them find other resources, you know, help them find a Zonta scholarship or this or Oregon, you know, some other access to other resources, because when you look at that scanty number, that is their income, many of our families. And so that, again, is why the tuition and fees, all those offsets are just so important, because as Dr. Forshee began talking about, we can't leave our students with student debt, because once they graduate, they still can't pay. You know, they still haven't stepped up in that.
Representative Bynum, Chair Lively, if I may add, many of our students also are only able to take one course at a time. Mm-hmm. So if you heard many of the family child care providers here today, they're with children, and they squeeze in at the very end of the day or on a weekend one course per term, which does not qualify them for financial aid. We also have students who may not qualify based on their immigration status, and they would not qualify for financial aid.
Questions? Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. That's very helpful. I do believe we have one more person in the audience, Ingrid Anderson from Portland State. We have a few minutes, so if you'd like to come forward, defend, or whatever you need to do with Portland. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Certainly.
So, Chair Lively, members of the committee, thank you so much for letting me speak today. For the record, my name is Dr. Ingrid Anderson, and I am at Portland State University wearing many hats. I work both for the Early Childhood Council, which is a provost initiative that supports the over 60 faculty who work in five different colleges on research from birth to through age 8, teach and provide services out into the community. I'm also co-coordinator of the Masters of Early Childhood Program and the Infant Mental Health Graduate Certificate. We have currently, in the last 2 years, have gone to an online program, and I wanted to tell you a little bit about the benefits of online supports. We currently have over 120 students registered in the last 2 years. We've seen a significant leap in the amount of students who are able to attend college, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. We have currently an initiative with the Oregon Health Authority with 40 students attending undergraduate work in early childhood and infant toddler mental health, 80% of which come from rural Oregon. The majority of our students are connected to early care and education programs such as Head Start, Relief Nurseries, private pay programs, etc. Students have shared their experiences, everything from conducting a parenting visit outside a duck blind during hunting season to traveling over 50 miles to see a family. They've spoken of their isolation and their need for professional supports. And I'd like to share just a few things with you that they have shared with us. When they speak to the online environment, they speak to the need to support each other because we're important to children, and their health and their formative education are the future of our society. And sometimes I feel like we're the only people who get it, and it's a heavy burden on some days, but we shoulder it together and it makes the difference. Another student shared with us, I was increased hope is something that I'm able to take through the wonderful and valuable course readings videos that we were fortunate enough to be exposed to over the last 10 weeks. It's also something that I got from you, my fellow students. Anytime I read an article, watch a video, or have a conversation with someone about the importance of early childhood experiences, it truly gives me hope. We work in a field where we know what we're doing is so important, but we often feel invisible in our society. Anytime I encounter someone who recognizes the validity of building positive early childhood systems, my hope grows. It gives me great comfort to know that I'm not the only one driven to make changes in our society for healthier, happier children and families. Online learning can create a sense of community that extends beyond the physical space of the classroom. Even in urban environments, a sense of isolation can be overwhelming, where early childhood educators work in classrooms or in family child care homes, where access to experience is limited to the end of long days or on the weekends. One family child care provider spoke with me and she shared, "I feel like my family is cheated in this job because there's way more than a full-time job and it's still not done. Take my weekends. I buy food for the week on my weekends, prepare the activities, clean and vacuum. So it's not done. It's never done. If a parent picks up their child late, then I miss time with my own children. I go upstairs and there's no one to have dinner with. So I don't see anyone. I don't ask them how their day was, and sometimes I don't get to see my family until the next day." Professional identity in communities of practice then becomes a key to high-quality experiences for young children, the ability to make connections and feel like you're part of a community. In Oregon, we have many points of disruption that impact professional identity for our early childhood educators. This includes uneven professional preparation and highly individualized paths on how they come to work. It also includes the act of It also includes the subjective professional identities that then are developed out of these unequal paths, which increase the inconsistency of practice and impacts quality experiences for young children. In my own research, I examine how subjective professional identity leads to a lack of consistent engagement in practice. And one of the things that we really need to do is explore the options that address the isolation and figure out ways to build community beyond physical space. We can create supportive environments that move beyond a set time and space and open up opportunities for meaningful learning and community building that engage early childhood educators. Our virtual classrooms provide rich experiences that embrace the holistic nature of early childhood and bring all strands of the field together to create cross-sector collaborations that build resiliency in early childhood educators and out into our community. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you so much. That kind of tied it all together, and then we heard more about the online. Mm-hmm. But this whole thing of being able to reach to different people, especially at the higher education level, so that was. I'm glad you came down and participated.
Thank you so much.
Sure. So I'm going to close the informational hearing. Colleagues, at this point, we have no other items that we're going to conduct today. So the House Bill 2643, we will not be conducting a work session on it today, and we'll be dealing with that bill in a different form later. And I would just tell you, going forward, all of the bills we'll be hearing will be listed in addition, besides the hearing, as a possible work session, because we're getting to that time. We have to decide. Doesn't mean we'll conduct work sessions at that time, but they'll be on the agenda that way. So if we decide, if it goes, we want to, we can do that. So any questions? Okay. Not, we'll adjourn. Okay.